My MarkTech Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
That's time.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is A-Test. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for the Weimar Technical Net. Weimar Technical Net is here Monday night at 8 p.m. And tonight, in the case of our post-field day edition of the Weimar Technical Net. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you about my usual link. Okay, as always, if you can't get into the repeater and you want to contact me, either to have me mail bad questions, bring up a topic you'd like to hear discussed, share a puzzle with me. I have a few puzzles that, if we have time, we'll get into later on in the net. Or if you want me to tap call WS2N on the shoulder and ask them to take a look at some NASA news or space-related news and comments, the email to reach me is mailbag@acts.com. Again, mailbag@acts.com. Just this week, I got my first spam email posted to that address, so someone must be using it somewhere, somehow. I have links available. The first few links either are space-related, and I leave to Paul to discuss at his wish, and other things are more visual, so they're not really things you can discuss on radios, but I found them interesting nevertheless. And the second section is links that I have thought were interesting, and if we have time, we can discuss it later on in the science talk. And my link page remains roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's busy as anything, and sometimes it's not quite that busy. You can either get to it by going to Limar's own website, finding the link there and clicking it, or you can just type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and it'll bring you to our chat room. I have a stream of this audio on the internet so that if you have friends or such that do not have access to either local radios or Echolink or IRLP, you can still point them to their browser and have them type in technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring them an audio stream of the Weimar repeater that I have running in the background 24/7. That as a means to live your stream at any time that you wish. And always remember, Mike, KC2NJI, has a wonderful archive of past technical nets. His site has archives going as far back as December of 2006. That's all available at his site, which is amateurradio.tv. Okay, let me drop and I'll tell you what I have planned for you tonight. Okay, as is always, we will ask for people with any questions or topics or comments for the technical net. If you have any questions of a technical nature, if you had questions in the past and you've tried different things and come up with some new information, if you've discovered something useful and interesting to amateur radio technology, what you need to do is hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign, and I'll put you on the list, and we'll go down the list in an orderly fashion. If we run out of people, I'll ask for if anyone has any other questions or such, or I'll have a couple of puzzles available later on tonight, and if time permits, some articles that I pulled from websites of scientific nature. So hopefully we'll have something nice and cool for you. Around 10:15 or so, Paul, WS2N, will bring us the SpaceNet report, which will take us to approximately 11 p.m. I'll come back, I'll tie a bow on it, and wish you well, and have a happy week, and bid you to return next Sunday night when we'll try and do this all over again. Hopefully, at some point or other, some people will volunteer what they did today and yesterday. That'll be interesting as well. So that's my plan, if the repeater and my radio will allow me to undertake it. Let me drop for a second and ask if anyone would like to have their name on the list for any questions or topics. If so, give me your first name and your call sign.
Hey, and one Whitey White.
Good evening, Roy. This is Wayne, KD2UZU. I have a field day question.
Okay, Hank and Wayne recognize. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? We'll give it one more time. Again, later on I'll probably ask again, if not a few dozen times. But if you want to get your name on the top of the list so you don't have to wait too long, please hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign if you have any questions or topics or comments for tonight.
Good evening, this is Raymond. KD2DYY, just listening in.
Okay, Raymond recognized. Once again, anyone else out there wants to put their name on the list for tonight, if they have any questions, if they have any topics they'd like to bring up, or if they would like to regale us with stories of how they experienced the last few days of field day. We'll take that also as risk for this event. All you have to do is hit that switch to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-ray Mike with field day subject.
Roy, it was the sixth station trying to check in. This is WS2N.
Okay, the sixth channel, it might have been through Echo Link, Jeff, AB6MB. I have checked you in, Jeff. I assume you don't have a question, but if you do have a question, you can type it in. I'm looking at your text screen. Jeff, AB6MB, has a very good antenna technology net on the Papa network on the West Coast. It's every Friday night, by the way, at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. There are different ways that you could access Papa Network, and it's a very informative and entertaining technical event. So keep that in mind if you're a TechNet collector.
Control, this is KD2, Hotel Charlie Uniform. Eric, I'm just listening in.
Okay, Eric recognized. Anyone else, feel free. If you have a question, have a topic, have a comment, or would like to regale us with stories of how you spent the last 2 days during field day, and if you want to put your name on the list, please hit the push to talk key and do it now.
GXM.
Very good, Rich. Yes, I have you. Have you in the third position for comments? So very good. So I have Hank, I have Wayne, and I have Rich for comments tonight. So let us begin at the top. Hank, N1YDY, how are you, Hank? And what do you have, what question, what topic do you wish to start off this episode of Tactical Net with? Okay, Hank, it's a very good question. There's something off, I think, with your radio. It's your audio is very, very low, and there's this interesting clicking thing that's going on about once every, I would say, half a second or so.
That's what happens to Richie K2KMB when he has his cell phone near the radio.
Okay, yeah, maybe it's some kind of interference. Hank, if you want to do a little experiment, if you have your cell phone anywhere nearby, take it and put it someplace far away and try again. Yes, I did have the cell phone close to the radio. I just turned it off, but it takes a second. So let me see if you can hear me any better now. Well, it may not have had time to go completely off because it's still ticking and the audio's still low. So it's see that, and we're waiting for a delayed effect, or is something else that's interfering radio?
Does it sound like it could be a power supply problem?
Difficult to say. I mean, it could be, it sounds more like there's some kind of RF getting into a microphone preamp. But you know, I mean, that's not an obvious thing. You know, it could be other things. But for some odd reason, affecting the audio and introducing some interesting clicks and artifacts, a click artifact into your audio signal.
Well, I turned the cell phone off, and when I transmit low power on this radio, 25 watts, when I transmit, the fan comes on the power supply, so I'm wondering if that has something to do with it.
Okay, well, for whatever reason, your audio at times is relatively stronger this time. It still has the clicking. I can still understand what you're saying. It's just I wanted you to be aware that there's something a little wonky. But you brought up a very good subject. Probably one of the first things I ever mentioned on the Limark repeater about 10 years ago, soon after I got my license, I was listening to Wesley and John of Memory, Silent Key. And I think it was Wesley who brought up the question of what happens as you shrink a piece of wire in a radiating antenna. And it's rather fascinating what happens. What effectively you do is you decrease the skew of the tuned circuit that the antenna is. By lowering the skew, you effectively broaden the bandwidth. This is why a cage antenna is so effective. RF is kind of goofy in that you don't need a fully tuned surface. If you simply, depending upon the wavelength that you're using, you can have holes punched in your radiating body. But if it's effectively a thicker radiating body instead of a thin wire, if it's a tube or even a tube with a bunch of holes punched in it, it will have a lower skew and a broadened bandwidth. So that's pretty much what you get out of that. There's a secondary effect, even though there's a skin effect. If you increase it to a degree, you produce a slightly lower insertion losses in your antenna. Depending upon your radiation resistance, if your radiation resistance is high, that's not really that important. If you have a shortened antenna where the radiation resistance is somewhat low, then any insertion loss is going to introduce efficiency. So by broadening the copper, you give it a greater surface and you lower the resistance of the radiating antenna. So the primary thing is broadening the bandwidth. The secondary effect can be improving efficiency somewhat.
Okay, if I may ask a follow-up question, I've seen things on the internet that describe spirally wound copper tape antennas on top of PVC tubes as being a method of allowing you to get a dipole rather than a ground plane in the same physical space. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's doable. I mean, ultimately, it's not that much different than a slinky antenna, which was people who took actual slinkies and used them antennas. They usually don't make great antennas because most slinkies that are in plastic are made out of some form of steel, so the resistance is rather high and the insertion losses are rather high as well. But a helical design for an antenna introduces interesting artifacts to a degree because in addition to kind of bringing down the overall linear length of the radiating antenna, you're also introducing additional inductance, which is going to allow for a shorter length as well. There are inductive losses when you start to use loading coils, though the efficiency isn't quite up to the same as a fully ended dipole, but it certainly is doable. A couple of months ago, one of the people on the TechNet was very fascinated by that. I think he read an article in QSC, and he was planning to build a modified version for a different band. Unfortunately, I don't think he's back with the results. So if he's out there tonight, and he'd like to share with us, that would be nice.
All right, well, thank you very much. And by the way, I've used a different radio and a different antenna, and I'd like to know if the problems are still following me.
No, they have thankfully left you. Your audio is nice and strong. I do not hear any background noises whatsoever. You're not full quieting into the repeater. It's about a 10-15% background noise, but it's a much, much, much better readable signal.
All right, well, thank you very much for discussing the antenna with me. You might recall that I'm trying to get something up as high as possible, and the condo or HOA is being a little bit resistant, so I might have to be a little surreptitious to and put something inside one of their decorative cupolas on the roof.
Have you ever considered a flagpole? That seems to be the go-to solution of a lot of people down south that I've been listening to.
Well, I've considered it. It's not approved in the HOA agreement, unfortunately.
Nah, it's a shame you can't go for their patriotism. Oh, well. Well, I wish you good luck, Hank, and please, if you have any further questions, come back, or if you found a good solution to share with the rest of us, please come back and tell us about that.
Well, and one final question, getting back to the cupola. The cupolas have a metallic wind vane on their top. I certainly can't load that because it moves with the wind and would be quite noisy. But would having a piece of metal on top of a radiator, not in the near field, but vertically on top of it, would that affect the signal in a dramatic way?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by on top of it, but not in its near field. It would strike me that that would be in its near field, unless I'm missing something.
You are not missing something. I misspoke. What I was thinking is that most of the radiation that we're interested in is not vertical. It's horizontal from the antenna, and in order to have a vertical signal. And the wind vane itself would have to be mounted above the ground plane if I were to put it inside one of these cupolas on the top of the roof. And I'm wondering if that would decouple the antenna or hurt the antenna in any measurable way.
Well, you know, out of the near field, you're perfectly safe. My problem is, once you go into the near field, strange things do happen. Now, I'm assuming definitely that you're not just going to put the vane right on top of the whip of the antenna and make it a capacitive hat. Although that would sort of be fascinating, except that you really wouldn't want your capacitive hat to rotate in the wind. You might suffer some kind of problem if it's really close to the tip, even though, as we've talked a lot, that the overwhelming majority of most of the reception and the transmission occur closer to the antenna point. It might be tuned a little bit. And I don't know if, as it rotated, the degree of detuning character. I mean, it might be an interesting experiment as well.
All right, I'll keep the group advised if I have any breakthroughs and get anything to work. And with that, N1YDY clear, and thank you.
Okay, very good, Hank. I wish you a great deal of luck there. Next on my list for tonight is Wayne, KD2UDU. What's your question for tonight, Wayne?
BXL is in there, right? WS2S. Okay, scoring. When I was a tech, I bought a arrow antenna with the intention to shoot satellites, and I dabbled in it briefly, but I had planned during the field day to enhance our score by shooting the satellites. They're supposed to be 100 points each, and I was informed that you're only allowed one in a club score for field day. But then I subsequently saw on the internet somebody was boasting that they got 22 satellites to score. So do you know what the actual rule is?
Now, feel free, anyone out there who's read the rules later than I have, because they paid rather quickly, but I believe that the first gentleman told you the truth. There's a lot of things that you can get bonus points for, but you can't rack them up by doing them over and over and over again. It's kind of like, I guess what it amounts to is the ARRL assumes that, you know, if you can earn the first 100 points, you could earn an almost endless amount thereafter. So it didn't serve their purpose. They're more interested in just motivating people to set up those types of systems. So as far as I understand it, the first guy was right. You can only take the first 100 points on the first contact or group. But if there's anyone else out there who's either a lawyer or who have read the rules later than I and feel that I got it all wrong, please feel free to hit that push to talk button.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
As far as I remember, every year it's been 100 points, you know, just for the one satellite contact, and that's it. By the way, I heard BXO in there trying to check in 2 minutes ago. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, are you sure it was BXO? Because Jeff, the AB6MC, wants to tell us about his field day exploit. So, are you sure it was Frank?
It sounded like Frank. All I heard was BXO toward the end. Might listen for him.
Okay. Getting back to Wayne. So Paul kind of agrees with me. I think the other guy was being a little bit on the foolish side, and he was kind of look at me without reading the rules. So I would advise you that the first person is right, and the second person is just a bit of a braggadocious person who doesn't read the rules.
Roy, thank you very much. The second person was just somebody on the internet, on Facebook, on a radio site. So I'm glad I didn't waste a lot of time trying to shoot. There wasn't too many passes overhead during field day anyway. And
WB2BXO here while I can get a word in edgewise.
Okay, well, thanks you, Wayne, Frank recognized. Frank, do you have any questions, comments, or what have you, or you're just checking in? I'll go easy on the push to talk button and give you opportunity to get in through EchoLink.
Okay, very good, Roy. I really didn't intend to interrupt the net. I heard the repeater drop out and wanted to see, was it the repeater or was it my Wi-Fi that dropped out? In any case, quickly, the first, and I would suggest somebody simply look it up in the rules on the ARRL website to make sure you have it right. As I recall, one contact counts for the 100 bonus points. Any additional contacts via satellite would count as regular contacts. That's my understanding from doing satellite contests years ago. But I suggest somebody actually read the rules rather than speculating. It's not exactly hard to find them. I'm in the middle of, like, three other things right now, so I'm not going to do it. The other thing was, a couple of weeks ago, I know I had put on the docket to talk about they were, and I wasn't able to get on. I think EchoLink had a problem, or I don't remember whether it was that, or I just had another commitment. And I wonder if later, I understand SLS has a big problem, that some technician dropped the piece and broke it. I don't know if that's accurate, maybe one of you guys will address that later if you've heard that. Anyway, back to net. Your B2BXO.
Okay, Frank. Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, you had a mailbag question about charging I think it was something like an 1800 milliwatt amp hour rechargeable with a 36,000 milliamp hour rechargeable. And actually, EchoLink, I think, was working. You must have had something else going on that night, because I kept on kind of looking at EchoLink and dragging things out, because I wanted to give you an opportunity to check in for it. But we can go over it again at the end of the list of the of people and questions and such. That's no problem.
All right, if you covered it, I can always find it on the recording. So I'll leave it to you guys. Anyway, thanks for letting me in. I will be listening at least for a while. BB2BXO.
Okay, very good. Glad to have you here, Frank. Rich, do you mind if I take Jeff first? Jeff is on the West Coast using EchoLink, and sometimes those connections break down. So, Rich, do you mind if I go to Jeff first for his stories of field day?
Don't mind at all. Take your time, and life is good. WV2GXO.
Yeah, unfortunately, Frank's EchoLink is kind of locked in the on position, and he's transmitting, which is curious. I kind of thought that EchoLink was problematic in that anyone would do anything and it would sort of break the EchoLink contact, but I guess it doesn't right now. Okay, Frank discovered the problem and he cut the connection. So Jeff, AB6MD. Of the Papa Network and Antenna TechNet every Friday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You wanted to tell us how you enjoyed your field day this past 2 days.
Thank you very much, Roy. Yeah, just my home station here has a very simple antenna going out to my screen on my window to a small tree and then along the fence line, so it's not the greatest antenna in the world. Probably about 10 or 12 feet above the ground, maybe about 20 feet above the ground, and I end-load it via 9-to-1 and run it on basically 10 to 40 meters. What's kind of unique about my field day is my friend came in remotely and joined me via a Zoom session, so I had his video up in the corner, and we used a Chrome remote desktop to allow him to operate my desktop on FTA, and that's all we ran, and it worked very, very well. He did it last year and did it again, so he was about 100 and some odd miles north of me. And so if anybody wants to have their buddies join them, that is one way of doing it. Works very, very well for the digital mode. Probably you could do something with the analog mode with that setup. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that. We had really good results. Antenna was picking up all sorts of signals on 40 meters, on 20 meters. First we did FT8, and then he had to take off. And then after that I did single sideband on 40 meters, and actually did pretty well, made a whole bunch of contacts. So with that, Roy, I'll turn it back to you. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Okay, very good. I'm glad you enjoyed yourself during field day. I'm telling you, remote operating is adding a whole new dimension in my mind to this hobby. It's leading to a couple of questions that people have. What happens when you remotely control a radio that's in a different region than you? Do you have the right to put it in a workable state if you're remotely operating in New Hampshire and you finally made that New Hampshire contact that was, a block and a half away from your remote station? So there's a couple of ethical, moral questions that kind of need to be addressed, at least for contactors. But there's so much software out there, and it seems every year there's more that allows you to remotely access all kinds of different radios. My Flex radio has a specific built-in feature to be remotely used, and I know of people who kind of set up their Flexes in their upstate residence, and they come to the city to work, and they remote through it and out. There are companies like Remote Ham that make a business of renting out rather sophisticated apps for remote access and all. So remotely controlled radios is just another wonderful technology that adds to the incredible number of different things you could do with our life. So I'm glad you enjoyed yourself and took advantage of that.
It worked out very, very well. We've done it 2 years in a row, and I have done remote operating to the East Coast. As on a remote, there's another one that's a free version of Remote Ham. Works very, very well, but right now I can't remember the name. Find it on Google. So back to you, Roy, AB600.
Okay, very good, Jeff. And like I said before, you can't sleep with our hobby because next year there's going to be a new technology that's going to take the people in a whole different direction. You know, remember when MT8 from Joe Taylor and his crew released it, kind of revolutionized contesting or DXing. You could sit there and semi-automate an FDA system, and while you're doing something else almost at the same time, make dozens and dozens of contacts that you otherwise couldn't. And a few years earlier, if you would have told someone you're interested in FDA, you wouldn't have the same idea what you were talking about. So ours is not a kind of ossified hobby. Where everyone kind of uses stuff that's 50, 60, 70 years old. Some people like to use vintage equipment, but it's a brave new world out there, and there's a lot of very clever people bending the envelope of our hobby. So I wish them good luck in those endeavors. There's a lot of work on Class E AM transmitters that goes on 75 meters. So, in all directions, microwaves, low-frequency operations. People are tinkering with all kinds of things, and I can't wait to hear the new stuff that they come up with. So, very good. Thank you very much, Jeff. Next on my list is Rich, WB2TXF. Good to hear you, Rich. Tell us your story.
Thank you. We had a great field day this weekend, and it was actually my first real field day ever. But I have not been participating in field day over the past years. So it was a lot of fun. I was working with the Nassau Amateur Radio Club. And we were in Baldwin Harbor Park. We had three stations running CW, SSB, and FT8. And we made over 600 contacts. And I learned the value of having a team. We had, many times we had someone with good ears on the CW decoding and someone who could not understand everything on the key and logging. And that combination was very, very winning for us. WBTGXM.
Well, it sounds like you had a lot of fun, which is the point of the exercise. It's kind of amusing that almost everyone, when they talk about field day, they say, field day is not a contest, but... And then they discuss how the points are distributed and such. So I'm glad you enjoyed yourself. I think it's always best to kind of enjoy it in groups. It's kind of difficult to enjoy it as a single individual, although most people, I think, last year were operating one Delta, which is basically a guy in a shack. There still are a lot of one Deltas out there. There's also some 1Es out there where they cut the outlet power to their rig and they operate on batteries and such. So I'm glad that you had fun. I assume that now you're looking forward to next year's field day.
Absolutely, Roy. In fact, I would encourage anyone who is considering or has operated by themselves to join a group. It's, the energy is contagious, and the camaraderie is infectious. It's just wonderful. You have a great, great weekend. You learn things that you would not learn if you were just operating by yourself. Yada, yada, yada. It was all great. WB2JXM.
ACTS. Well, yeah. We've all had to go through the same year and a half. It's been a rather antisocial time. People have kind of unfortunately learned how to deal with things by themselves. Hopefully, as things progress and things open up, we'll be more of a community than a bunch of individuals. But yeah, that's part of the charm of Field Day. It's the interaction of a bunch of like-minded people. I'm looking forward to hopefully people sending pictures into their club and having them posted on their website. I hope Weimark does it. I belong to the King County Radio Club as well. I hope they do it. I look forward to seeing the smiles on people's faces from their accomplishments. So I'm very pleased. I'm very happy to hear you with a really happy tone. It's nice to hear. And so I thank you for telling us about your experiences these past few days.
Thank you, Roy. Glad to hear your voice as well. WB2JXM, passing the baton to other people with other stories.
Yes, indeed. This is a perfect opportunity to kind of get people out there and to tell their story of their experience these last 2 days. Yes, some people operated individually, some people operated in small groups, some operated in rather large groups. And I would love to hear the story. In the old days, I used to love to hear the stories of Dick, K2RIW. We come upon field day operators late at night and sit by the fire and regale them with stories of antennas that he had experienced and give basically antenna theory sessions during the middle of the night on field day. I used to love to hear those stories. So if anyone out there has any stories to share with us of the last 2 days, to put a cherry on top of this year's field day, please hit the push the talk button and give me your call sign and your name.
Sorry, GXM with a follow-up, and then I'll go on.
Yes, Rich.
You had reminded me about the antennas, and I hadn't mentioned to you, but I'll run down the two winners that we had this past weekend. Our club erected an L, top L, with radials. Let's see, 30 or 40 feet vertical, going to about 50 or 60 feet horizontal to a remote mast. That was a winner. And the other one that came in second was a Cobra antenna, which we erected as an inverted V. That was very nice. We got onto 80 meters and 40 meters with that. Actually, we got onto all the bands with that, as it is a multi-band antenna. All right, I'm done. WB2GXM.
Okay, very good. I've heard stories ranging all the way from guys bringing in mobile towers and erecting them for the 2 days, to on the other end of the spectrum, a guy is flying a bit of wire on a kite. So, you know, whatever radiates works. And so people have used all kinds of very, very clever devices. Usually they mount the wire antennas of some kind. Either they're operating an end-fed wire or a dipole, either in the inverted V or just the horizontal position, depending upon the topology of the ground and such. But, you know, whatever resonates and radiates works. So, great. I'm glad to hear. Once again, if anyone else out there has any stories to tell of the last 2 days of their field day experiences, I would love to hear it.
KT2RY.
Yes, David.
You know, for me, ham radio, like field day, almost every day. I hope that everyone had an extraordinary field day. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. As do I, David. I hope everyone enjoyed themselves, and I hope that you didn't tire them out too much. My other club, the Kings County Radio Club, when I first joined it 10 years ago, one of its primary motivating forces was to plan for the next field day. It seemed like they started to plan for it in the end of June, about an hour and a half after a field day ended. They started to plan for the next one. It's an exciting event for many, many years. So I just wish I can cajole some of you guys out there who usually just sit back and listen to participate tonight and to share with us your insights and your experiences these last few days. Oh, well, I'll try one more time to cajole. I know my crowd is kind of difficult to cajole at dawn, but if anyone out there would like to put in their 2 cents of how they spent the last 2 days of field day and what they got out of it, again, this is as good a time as any. Just hit that push-to-talk button.
Okay, GXM with one more anecdote.
Okay, Rich.
I had kind of forgotten about this, but as it turns out, one of the people in my club, which this weekend was the NASA Amateur Radio Club, is the volunteer examiner who gave me my extra class exam. There you go, WV2GXM.
That's great. It's good to have that connection with it's sort of vaguely like in the PhD program. Guys who worked for a PhD do it under a guy who, or a woman who had a PhD, who worked for another person who had a PhD, who worked for another person who had a PhD, and you can kind of academically trace them back through their PhD lineage. So in a way, to a lesser extent, it's interesting the people who signed your license form. I know one of the guys who signed my license form 10 years ago is a very, very active DE. So every 2 months when QSC publishes the top DE examiners, he's always there. So it's always nice to have a sense of continuity, and that's nice that you bumped into him as well. Okay, we'll kind of put the questions on pause, because I get a sense that there's not a lot of questions out there. And we'll do a couple little puzzles. Maybe that'll warm people up or make them think of some kind of questions for tonight. For my first puzzle for tonight, I will ask you both a simple and maybe not so simple question. Do protons taste like anything? And if they do taste like anything, what do you think protons taste like?
GXM.
Yes, Rich.
I would say that the protons would taste like whatever receptors they tend to land on your tongue, being that they are an electrical charge.
Okay, but could you be a little bit detailed about that?
Okay. Salty, WB2GXM.
Okay, that's a good guess. The salt receptors are ion channels. They're designed for a very common ion channel. Our cell membranes in our body are stuffed to the nines with both sodium channels and potassium channels. by using ATP with an energy molecule, it pushes excessive amounts of sodium outside of the cell and fat inside the cell. So that when it can release them and cause the cell to act in an interesting and curious way. The problem, though, is that protons don't activate the sodium ion channel in the taste buds. So you wouldn't taste salt if I gave you a dose of protons.
Oh, DDH for the comic.
Yes, John.
Well, isn't every ion that's going to interact going to have a layer of an electron shell around it? That's never really going to be a proton, direct proton interaction. This is always going to be with the electrons of the outer shell or the, whatever shell exists, if it's an ion. Go ahead.
Well, with the exception of one element, actually two elements, yes, but there are those two elements, hydrogen and helium. If you ionize a hydrogen at all, you're left with a proton. If you ionize the helium, you have to rip both of the electrons off. Then you're only left with a proton and a stabilizing neutron.
Well, then I would guess bitter, because any acid when it ionizes is going to have a hydrogen ion. Acids generally taste bitter, so that would be my guess.
Okay, John, that makes a lot of sense, and you worked it through logically. The only problem is that bitterness isn't really caused by acidity. Bitterness is an evolutionary tendency. It's a much more complicated taste, actually, than all the others, whereas all the others are a single type of sensory device. Bitter is actually, I think, something like 60-plus molecular lock-in key sites on the taste buds. It recognizes a molecule. When a certain type of molecule reaches it and gets real close to it and fits in the lock, it changes the conformation of that molecule in the cell wall that triggers it. It gives us the bitter taste. But bitter is primarily a way that we evolve against poison. A lot of things that are poisonous are bitter. So they're not sour, they're bitter. So, anyone want to hazard a guess? I took the cat out of the bag with my last response, so it shouldn't be too difficult to figure out what a proton tastes like. Yes, NVB.
Yes, Bob K. NVB. Well, with your last hint and your very attention to being a hint, I would say it's something to be different. But I don't know if that's anything to do with it. If they're having a positive charge or something like that, I don't know if that's anything to
do with it. I'm a little confused, Bob. You vote for bitter as well?
Yeah, I was going to tell a little field day story at Barber tonight. I did it all by myself. I was having a big day now. I'm so famous. I was better than my toast at dinner. Okay, I will say bitter right now. Maybe I should have said
it. Okay, so I'll put you down for bitter. Anyone else out there want to hazard any kind of a guess? I don't want to kick a dead horse. I've been accused of kicking dead horses in the past. I don't want to be accused again, but still. If anyone else has any thoughts on the matter of what a proton might taste like, please hit that push to talk button. Okay. We have only a few basic tastes that we can perceive. Sweet, sour, bitter, umami. Umami is an interesting taste. It's kind of a meatiness. What it actually is it checks things with proteins in them, glutamate and such. So monosodium glutamate gives you this umami taste. So let's go back to the only thing that I haven't really discussed too much, which is sour. Sour is basically a way of telling what the pH, the acidity of your food is. If it has too much acid in it, it's sour. What really acidity means is hydrogen ions in solution. So effectively, the receptors for your sour taste is a simple ionized hydrogen atom, or otherwise known as a proton. They're proton channels. And so when a proton, a charged proton without its electron exists in an acid milieu, reach that part of your tongue receptors, it goes down the proton channel that's in the cell and activates your sour receptors. So protons taste sour by almost pretty much by definition. Okay, let's try another little one. What is black when you buy it, red when you use it, and gray when you throw it away? Anyone out there want to play this game?
VDH?
Yes, John.
I was going to say charcoal.
You are the winner. Yes, charcoal. Black when you buy it, red hot when you use it, and white gray when the ashes are left behind. So the answer is charcoal. You win a gold star today, John. So here's my third and final puzzle. I find this particularly interesting myself. Everyone kind of knows the story of canaries in the mineshaft. In the old days, it is said that it was not that difficult to become asphyxiated in mine shafts. So there were pockets of non-oxygen gas that sometimes were opened and flooded the area. And if left to the miners, eventually they would succumb to the lack of oxygen and die. So very often they would bring down animals that were much more sensitive to a drop in oxygen level. One of them was a canary bird. So the story was that they would bring these little canaries in a cage, and if the canary fell off its perch, they knew they were in for trouble. So that's the old story about the canary in the mine shaft. So my question vis-a-vis that is, I do not believe that NASA has ever brought a canary into space. They brought all kinds of other animals. Does anyone out there know if there's a reason why NASA never tried to bring a canary into space?
Public relations.
Well, Rich, that would be a good reason. I think they kind of blew it with the monkeys, because I think you get a bigger PR hit by killing a monkey than killing a canary.
The spacesuits don't fit.
You are quite right. As far as I'm aware, there is no agreed-upon design for canaries. But unfortunately, it's something incredibly more fundamental than even not having the right dress to wear.
WS2N, I have a guess.
Okay, Paul, I was hoping that you'd have something on this one.
They would have to fly, you know. You can't just put them in a 1 square meter box. You know, they have these experimental boxes on the space station. You know, for all these other little creatures that they bring up, experiment on. You know, you sure can't let them fly around the the space station. My guess is that, you know, you don't have the room, the volume for it.
Okay, that's a possibility. I guess theoretically, though, you could put them in a birdcage. And probably birds, after the first few attempts in either near zero or zero gravity, would be so confused, I would assume that they would stop using them for a while. So they probably wouldn't fly much. It would be kind of fascinating to see what a bird looks like trying to fly in a closed atmosphere space with either zero or near zero gravity. But that wasn't the fundamental reason. There is a really, really, really good reason why NASA decided on inspection of that idea. Definitely not.
GXM.
Rich.
On a more serious note, they probably couldn't control the waste management problem. WB2GXM.
Okay, that's an interesting thing. Birds have a cloaca. They don't produce liquid material. They have a very efficient kidney system. And so they discharge this solid waste from their cloaca. I guess it would be a bit of a pain in the backside in zero gravity because it wouldn't drop down. So you'd have to kind of grab it. Now, Paul knows this much, much, much better than me. But I believe that there were some unfortunate accidents in gravity, in zero or very low gravity, where people had to collect stuff that they didn't want floating around in the capsule. So I'll ask Paul for a comment on that little aspect. I believe that happened, right?
No, crazy, Tom. You're talking about losing stuff in space. That's happened a lot, you know, outside of the International Space Station. That happens quite a bit. But inside, you know, they might lose something and they can't find it, you know. 6 months later, they'll find a tool that they've been looking for. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, Paul, but wasn't there at least one time where someone's waste management equipment malfunctioned and there was stuff floating in the capsule that should be in the toilet?
On the Apollo flights, that happened, you know, with, which guy was sick as a dog on that one? Oh, okay, it was guy that eventually became president of Eastern Airlines, Frank Borman. That's exactly what happened to him. And, you know, you can imagine a crew of three heading to the moon, you know, on Apollo 8, running into that problem. That's the problem that they did have.
Yeah, one of many reasons why space traveling is probably not a good idea for most of us. Thank you very much, Paul. But getting back to Rich, I'm sure if they put their mind together, they'd come up with some kind of low-suction device that would kind of, at the bottom of the birdcage, that would kind of introduce a little bit of local motion on anything that dropped out of the poor canary. So, you know, I don't think that would quite stop NASA. It might slow them down for a day or two in the engineering department. Okay, one more time for anyone out there, if you want to hazard any kind of a guess, what's the problem with canaries and space? There is a rather severe one.
TD2FIU?
Yes, I heard John and I heard George. So I heard John a little bit before you, George, so we'll go to John and then we'll go to George. So John first.
Yeah, I would think any bird in gravity environment, in fact, would almost be cruel to trying to have them orient themselves in a low gravity environment. In fact, it would really be a problem.
Oh, okay. I mean, to a degree, probably you'd have the same problem with any kind of complex organism. They're not really designed for a low G. They, you know, human beings, a certain percentage of astronauts upchuck into their spacesuit, no matter what you do. We're just not designed for micro or zero gravity. And aside from the really detrimental effects it has on us over time with bone thinning and fluid redistribution and brain swelling, you know, it also screws up, gives us dizziness and other stuff. George, you wanted to say something.
Thank you, Roy. I'm taking a guess here. Maybe birds, and especially certain birds, more than others, have a natural...